Warning, you are about to listen to the greatest radio show ever. And due to contractual obligations and to shield our airwaves and corporate licensees from any semblance of liability, responsibility, and gullibility, we must tell you the views represented on this show are not necessarily those of this station or its management. This radio show contains differing points of view on current political topics, and due to the nature of its contents, it should be heard by everyone. Thank you for listening. 3, 2, 1. Now live from the Devil Radio Studios in Madison, Wisconsin, where the political party is just beginning. Welcome to the Devil's Advocate Show. Friends proving it's never personal, only politics.
Please allow me to introduce myself.
Here is your host, Mike Crute.
Good afternoon. This is the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. We are talking for the remainder of the Devil's Advocates Radio Show today all about the J6 Committee. Its hearing of earlier today broadcast live on this very station, chatting about the significant things coming out of that hearing, the revelations about this quite spectacular December 18th late night unhinged meeting, not so as one witness described it, in an attempt by the president, or more directly, his supporters in the names of Sidney Powell and Michael Flynn, to try to keep in office. And the fight that ensued between them and members of the White House staff, including Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, to try to bring this to an end, to stop this. But it happened over the course of several hours and resulted early in the morning of December 19th in the president's tweet inviting everyone, Americans, and in particular a certain subset of Americans, the Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, others who would believe in the lie that he was telling about the election being stolen, inviting them all to come to Washington, D.C. to try to overturn the legitimate results of that election. During the course of the introductory period of today's hearing on Capitol Hill by the J6 Committee, Liz Cheney from Wyoming, the vice chair, said, you know what, all that we're seeing falls into sort of three rings. Discussed a lot of this before, Mike Pence being one of those rings, an attempt to convince Mike Pence, contrary to the law, contrary to what Pat Cipollone and everyone knows, that he does not have the capacity to declare the election fraudulent and send the elective ballots back to the states. That was one ring. She talked about the second ring, much in focus today, of these extremist groups led by Stuart Rhodes, the Oath Keepers, Enrique Tarrio, and others, the Proud Boys, to coordinate this event on Capitol Hill, to undertake to overthrow what was going on there and stop the counting of ballots. And then third, Liz Cheney also said, focusing on January 6th and the things that the president said on the ellipse that day to encourage this large and increasingly angry crowd, thousands of people, enraging the rally, as she said, exciting them up, prompting them to walk down Pennsylvania Avenue, walk down the street and approach and then breach the Capitol and attempt to stop the proceedings from going forward. She mentioned, as did others, as did two of the principal presenters today, Stephanie Murphy from Florida and Jamie Raskin from Maryland, both parts of the committee. Both of them also talked about the fact that there was a noose placed on the Capitol grounds, presumably intended for the vice president of the United States of America. Jamie Raskin, at the end of the hearing today, talking about American carnage, not only on that day, but taking up the words that the president himself had said during the course of his inaugural statement, his inaugural address to America, describing this dystopian America that, in fact, as Jamie Raskin described this afternoon, he himself has now created this American carnage, again invoked by Jamie Raskin on January 6th in an attempt to undermine the legitimate election that happened in November of the previous year. We're taking your calls also about what happened today, the other significant findings. We're going to chat more about those, including the creation of the president's speech that he delivered on January 6th at the Ellipse, the significant events that also reveal his intent, his purpose, his power, if you will, his assumption of power in trying to command this unruly crowd, trying to bring them to the point of Fuhrer and to do exactly what they did. And then we're also going to chat a bit about these two witnesses who testified, Jason Tatenhoff and Stephen Ayers. One of them deceived for a long time by the Oath Keepers, but seeing the light of day and describing the fraudulent nature of what they do. The other one, Stephen Ayers, at the very end, describing how he himself, his life, the life that he had created with his wife, was also there, destroyed by accepting this invitation of the president to come to Washington, D.C., believing that the president was honest and true, when in fact, as Mr. Ayers testified this afternoon, now recognizing that this was all false, asked by, I believe it was Stephanie Murphy, asked by Jamie Raskin, if you knew then what you know now about what the president's knowledge was, that it was everybody telling him there was no the election had not been stolen. Mr. President, this effort is inappropriate. It is illegal. It is not in the best interest of the nation. Would you come? And Stephen Ayers said no. I lost my job. I lost my house. I felt like I needed to be there. Why? Because my president told me I needed to be there. Stunning, stunning testimony at the end of the day about the impact of what the president did in inviting the Jamie Ayerses of the world and also the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys and many others to Washington, D.C. Hundreds of people now indicted by, charged, many of them sentenced already for their involvement in that. Many more to come. We're taking your phone calls. And in fact, we do have a phone call. Lou, you're on the line with us. Your comment or question as we talk about the J6 committee this afternoon.
I found out that Hunter Biden's laptop says that $35 million was given to Biden by the Chinese. And I think they're going to impeach Merrick Garland when Republicans take over the House because he failed to prosecute those people who appeared in front of Supreme Court justices' homes. That's a federal law, and he chooses to disobey or not to pay any attention to it. Where do you get off doing that?
Well, and Lou, you should know that obviously the, for example, the young man, remember this story, the young man who showed up in front of Justice Kavanaugh's home and had the wherewithal in the end not to go ahead. He was plainly armed, plainly incited to do something terrible. Terrible, right? Probably to attack the justice's home, his family, perhaps the justice himself. Law enforcement did respond to that, and that young man has been charged. And so the Department of Justice does respond to those kinds of things. But appreciate the call and appreciate your calling in about that particular event. We will look forward to Merrick Garland. I want to make another comment about this, sort of collateral to what the caller just indicated, and that is that, you know, once again, the J6 committee, significant in terms of telling America what happened, hugely important to our understanding about what happened for government reasons, certainly for political purposes, for our historical understanding of what our nation was about and continues to be about. We're heading into another election later this year, again, yet another one in the following year here in the state of Wisconsin, and certainly 2024. Important for us to know as we make these all-important decisions about who should be representing us in the White House, in the Congress, frankly, in our state house, in the governor's mansion, in our state assembly, in our state senate, all those things important for us to know. And they also go to this question of whether or not there should in fact be legislation enacted by the Congress to ensure that this never happens again. You may recall well that during the course of the Watergate hearings, 1973 and so forth, Sam Ervin and Howard Baker, a bipartisan committee, advanced a huge package of legislation to ensure that the offenses that Richard Nixon, including things like an enemies list, that those would no longer happen. Violations of the tax laws. We're going to chat at the end of this hour about one of those by the Trump administration. Huge numbers of things done by the committee at that time in the early 1970s to stop this from ever happening again. That also a part of the January 6th committee. What needs to happen from this? And we can anticipate that their report, when it comes out presumably in September of this year, maybe before, maybe a little bit after, will also advocate not only for a change in the way we think about America, but specific legislative actions that can be taken to ensure that the offenses and the violations of law that happened under this prior administration don't happen again. So that's also a part of their function. The Department of Justice does not need a referral from this committee to pursue any of these cases in terms of both the people who were there on the ground on January 6th or, as Merrick Garland has said, the higher-ups who might be responsible for the conduct and organization that the committee committee was talking about today. Department of Justice has the independent authority to pursue that. They plainly are. We've got another caller who's been on hold for a while. We'll take that caller right now. Your comment, your question about our discussion this afternoon.
Who's this, me?
Yes, that's you. We're glad to have you with us. Go right ahead.
This is CJ from Stoughton. Glad to talk to you, James.
Yes, CJ?
Well, it took January 6th for the Democrats to actually care about crime and violence. And Attorney General Merrick Garland doesn't believe he has the case. There's no smoking gun. There's no directive from Donald Trump. Why don't you play the part in his speech where he said, go down to the Capitol peacefully. You and January 6th committee never play that part. And he listened to Cipollone. He didn't pursue exactly what he wanted to do. So the mere fact that Cipollone is actually testifying doesn't, you didn't hear Cipollone said, look at what Donald Trump did. He didn't say, you know what, Cipollone, I'm doing it regardless of what you say. And so this is going to be another 2.5 year, $25 million flop, just like Adam Penselneck Schiff did with the Russian collusion.
And Adam, I appreciate so much your comment. We appreciate all views on this good radio program. Appreciate perspectives in all senses of the word. You know, it's important, I think, to understand that the Department of Justice does have a responsibility to do things in a nonpartisan way. I was part of the Department of Justice for 30 years. And I can tell you, both as a U.S. attorney, both as an interim U.S. attorney and the presidentially appointed U.S. attorney, that issues related to politics, to what partisan politics what might otherwise suggest one would do, never, ever, ever came up. And they shouldn't be a part of the process. I have said before on this very radio show that the decisions to prosecute people for political reasons, for reasons that are not reflective of the facts in the law, those are no less, no more corrupt than a decision not to prosecute for the same reason. And while I take your point very well, and certainly there's a lot to digest here when it comes to Pat Cipollone and others here, we also have to understand that our Department of Justice, whatever the decision is made by Merrick Garland, has got to be premised upon the facts, got to be premised upon the law, and got to be premised upon what are called the principles of federal prosecution, which take into account a wide variety of things related to deterrence and punishment and the future. A lot of criminal prosecution, as you know, is in intended for the future, to ensure that future presidents, future potential criminal defendants, do not in fact engage in the same kind of conduct out there. So we appreciate that comment, and we're going to be talking more about the January 6th committee right after the coming break here on the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. I'm joined in the studio by Evan, always taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. Back. This is Jim Santel standing in for Mike Crute, who is away doing the business of the station today. I'm here in the studio with my producer, Evan, and we're taking your calls, your questions, your observations at 844-967-2789. The subject matter of our syllabus, our curriculum this afternoon, is the J6 Committee, having just spent about 2.5 hours on Capitol Hill revealing more about what happened before, during, and after January 6th. And right before the break, we were talking about a few more of those small tidbits and large items that were disclosed today. Among the things that might get lost in the fray, some of the news reporting on this, were some of the internal discussions going on, again, in early January, right before January 6th. And we heard today about a woman named Christina Pearson, who was also on the president's staff at the time, who, when she heard more about these groups, the Oath Keepers, led by Stuart Rhodes, and Proud Boys, led by Enrique Tarrio, Rubio began to monitor more and more some of the things that she was seeing in the public domain, online, other places, became increasingly concerned. Concerned also about people named Ali Alexander and Alex Jones, very well known to sort of the insurrectionist groups and counterculture groups out there. And she went to Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, about whom we've also heard an awful lot, went to Mark Meadows and said, you know what, Mark, things might get out of control here. We need to rein this in. That was in January 2nd, early in January, about the same time that there were also some of these other conversations being had in the White House, again, long after December 18th, this tumultuous discussion, this fight, this anger, this meltdown discussion that was had late at night, early in the morning. Early January, lots of discussions among people, again, in the White House. We know from some previous testimony of this committee that among those conversations was one in which the John Eastman, the sort of the architect of much of this design, involving both the vice president, involving false electors, involving people coming to Washington, D.C., involving changing the votes in six or seven different states, that Eastman himself was in the Oval Office talking with the president, acknowledging that the very thing that he was articulating in his memorandum would probably lose dramatically before the Supreme Court, 0-9, he said, recognizing and says in the presence of the president, there's no there. There's nothing to my memorandum, but we're still going to go out there and advocate for it. And sure enough, the president does, during the course of this same period, tell America, as he did in his tweet, many other appearances, both at the White House and beyond the White House, that the election has been stolen, and come to Washington, D.C. on January 6th for the very purpose of vindicating the horror, the thing that happened in early November, when in fact nothing horrific happened that day, aside from the normal, the procedural, the appropriate election of a president, as we have done for well over 200 years in this country. Katrina Pearson sounding the alarm once again to Mark Meadows about what she is seeing. Mark Meadows, as we know, also concerned at the time, even though publicly, since that time, has not condemned the president in a way that plainly internally he may have done at the time. We know CJ called before, and he was talking about the speech, the preparation for the speech the president gave on the Ellipse right across from the White House that morning. A huge amount of testimony this morning about, and this afternoon in particular, about how that speech came to be, and the president writing it well into the evening of January 5th. And specifically inserting and then removing lines about the vice president. Among the inserted and then removed lines, we'll see if Mike Pence will do his proper, appropriate job. And it turns out that, again, as a result of some intervention, probably by Pat Cipollone and others, that language is removed from the draft. And then the language, as it finally is presented to the Ellipse, the crowd in the Ellipse, includes that language once again. And the Pence line is reinserted. The president speaks about fighting in some ad libs to his speech. He says you have to be strong and you have to fight like hell. Significantly, that's put in context today by the committee. And when does that happen? That happens after he has a conversation that very morning with the vice president, kind of a last conversation, if you will, between the president and the vice president. The president plainly calling upon Mike Pence. Mike, will you do this thing for me, for the country? Will you find that these votes are not properly presented to you? Will you turn this back to the states? And Mike Pence, as we know from previous testimonies, saying, nope, I will not do that. He turns back on this. Pat Cipollone today in that recorded testimony confirms once again that Mike Pence takes this high road and refuses to do what the president is encouraging him to do. The president then turns around, goes out to the Ellipse, reinserts that language, encouraging, if you will, subtly or perhaps not so subtly, the continuing anger against Mike Pence as the one person who could overturn the election, who plainly may not do that. We know that Mike Pence did not do that, returned to the well of the House to read those votes after the insurrection is underway, even while the dust is still settling, and does in fact certify the Electoral College votes and opens the door then, if you will, to the proper entry into the White House office of Joe Biden on January 20th of this year. We know a lot about that. We also know that Brad Pascal, from today's testimony, a former campaign manager, also has a lot of conversation with this Katrina Pearson. And they go back and forth and talk about, gee, the efforts that could have been made to try to stop the president from saying those things on January 6th that revealed his intent, that revealed his purpose to incite this riot. In the end, Katrina Pearson attempting, if you will, to sort of put her arm around Brad and say, you know, we did our best. We tried as best we could. Brad Pascal in the end saying, in the end, it was the rhetoric. It was the rhetoric. It was the language that the president used that prompted this to happen. A bit more about what happened today in front of the January 6th committee when we return here in the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. A will to survive and a voice of reason. I'll be the one to protect you from your enemies and your choices, son. One and the same, I must isolate you. Isolate and save you from yourself.
Devil's Advocates, never personal, only politics.
And we're back for our final half an hour this beautiful Tuesday afternoon here in the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. My name is Jim Santel. Evan is my producer this afternoon. We are taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. We're chatting all day today about the J6 committee, the results of its 2.5 hour presentation today. It comes in the wake of another story that hit out of the Washington Post and some other media late last week that also puts in context everything that we chatted about earlier, this ellipse presentation, this ellipse speech that the president gave, what happened at the Capitol moments after that. Washington Post reporting that there were, among the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, huge numbers of weapons present with them at that time. We know well that the president, President Trump at that time, specifically asked that the people attending the ellipse assembly there, the rally there, not be subjected to reviews and searches because he knew that they had weapons. He was told they had weapons. Additional reporting these days that there were staged weapons beyond just the ellipse in the suburbs around Washington, D.C. There was military ordnance. There were grenades in the area. A huge amount of potentially even more horrific violence could have happened. Undeniably, a group, including the Proud Boys, including the Oath Keepers, heavily armed. We know that about 120 people or so have already been charged with weapons violations in connection with January 6th. Again, puts in context the seriousness of what was intended, including that of the President of the United States of America. And the J6 committee, again, beginning to draw what Jamie Raskin and Stephanie Murphy, the principal presenters today, Jamie Raskin, a congressman from Maryland, Stephanie Murphy, a congresswoman from Florida, described as this convergence of efforts that brought together the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and many others on January 6th on the ellipse at the Capitol itself for the riot there. And all the work not in a positive way designed to get that group, that crowd, that mob there in the first place. A lot of focus, again, upon this meeting of December 18th that resulted in the president inviting groups of people to come to Washington, D.C. on January 6th, encouraging them, as he would ultimately say, to fight like hell, presumably on his behalf. We know at the end of the proceedings today, we also heard from two witnesses who testified about their specific involvement, and one of them with the Oath Keepers and Stuart Rhodes, Jason Tatenhoff, who was for a while one of the principal media folks, was allied with Stuart Rhodes. Stuart Rhodes, as Tatenhoff indicated this afternoon, was a resident in his basement for a while. Tatenhoff today recognizing that his affiliation, his longstanding affiliation with Stuart Rhodes and the Oath Keepers was not only unwise, but plainly very dangerous, and ultimately said, I've got to distance myself from this group. Today, what did he say? He said, they are a militia. They're a very dangerous organization, and talked about the fact that this was an attempt to put together an armed revolution. This is from somebody, again, used to be affiliated with the Oath Keepers. He talked about the fact that there was this gallows set up on the Capitol Hill itself, presumably for the vice president or some other people there who had run afoul of the interests of the Oath Keepers and others there. And significantly said, what I saw there that day, this is coming from Jason Tatenhoff, could have been the spark to another civil war. That is his testimony today in front of the J6 committee. And then, as I said in the prior segment, this singular individual, Jason Ayers, there with his wife, probably being a representative person of so many who were there the day, who talked about being duped. Misled, deceived into coming to Washington, D.C. by a president who he trusted. When the president said to him, you know what, the election has been stolen, it has been taken away, Jason Ayers believed his president and believed what he was reading on social media, believed what he was seeing on Facebook, and said, I needed to be there because my president told me to be there. Described it as the worst mistake of his life, losing his job, his home, plainly having an impact upon his family. How many other Stephen Ayers are out there in the context of people who came to Washington, D.C., lives now forever affected, if not ruined, as we know as well. People died there that day. People dramatically impacted physically as well, psychologically, emotionally. The impact of what happened that day cannot be overstated. Dick, you're also on the phone this afternoon. We welcome your comments or your questions.
Well, to that last story, too bad, so sad. I hate to be so callous, but here I look at stuff, James, totally different than most people. For instance, this whole January 6th thing, what was going on in the same timeline they always bring up? COVID. And you know how they like to say, oh, the former president was responsible for warp speed? No, he wasn't. But we'll get by that. And even if he was, what kind of a leader or a president would have done what he was doing to just stay in power when thousands of people were still dying of COVID? And we all know now that when he left office, only about 3 or 4% of people were vaccinated, when in fact the vaccination was out there late in his presidency. I guess my question to you is, you know, guys, you people that are just such sycophants and that can't get over the fact that he lost, he still had a job to do. Absolutely. And his job became nothing more than self-preservation and to stay in freaking office.
Right.
As opposed to doing what you should do as a president.
No, Dick, I couldn't agree more. We talked earlier today about the notion that you take an oath in office, right? You take an oath in office to support the Constitution, to execute the laws, a duty of care to the American people. That's what your point is all about. Everything we heard about today and previous times, it's all about staying in power. It's not about serving the people of the United States of America. You know, Dick, when you speak about COVID-19 and what the president knew here, I think there are also some parallels here. Your point is very well taken. We know because of Bob Woodward's book, the very same time that this president, this former president, was telling us that this was not that big a deal, that we're not, no, don't need to be all that focused upon this, and plainly minimizing the significance of a virus that took the lives of more than 1 million people in the end, and 300 people continue to die to this day from this virus. We know from Bob Woodward that the same time that this president was saying those things publicly, minimizing the impact of this, telling people that they can in fact do things that they should not do, further spread the virus, we know that the president understood just the opposite, right? Because he told Bob Woodward that. We know that from the tapes. He tells Bob Woodward, Bob, this is a serious thing. It's a big deal. People are going to die. And turns around and says just the opposite to the American population. I would offer, Dick, following up on your very good comment here, that we have the same thing here. We've got a president who plainly knows. He has been told by everybody from his counsel to his own children. children, to people surrounding him, to everyone but the Rudy Giulianis and the Mike Flynns and the Sidney Powells of the world, that he did not, in fact, win this election. He knows that. He understands that. He is not a stupid human being. He is a deceptive. And what does he do? He goes out and he tells America that, in fact, the election was, in fact, stolen. And that, I would offer to you, is the ultimate in violation of your oath to work on behalf of the people of America, the people who put you in that office in the first place. It does not go to a criminal exposure, but it certainly, again, puts all of this in historical perspective. When our grandchildren think about this presidency, all of these kinds of things, COVID-19, Dick, as you say, the circumstances under which a lot of this happened, all of them have to be read together in terms of an administration that was not at the top, focused on what's best for America. We've got another caller, Gary, calling in. We're delighted to have you with us. Gary, okay, we're going to take Gary perhaps later on in the course of the program, but appreciate, again, all of your phone calls as they come in here on a regular basis. We're heading into the last portions of our discussion today about the J6 committee. We know at the very end of the committee, in addition to this testimony from Jason Tatenhoff and Stephen Ayers, that there was this very personal testimony about the impact of what happened on January 6th on them. This armed revolution, as Tatenhoff described it, this potential spark to a new civil war. Plainly, those things presented by this committee almost as victim impact statements. I think about many of these things in the context of what a trial would look like. The Stephen Ayers of the world, who, again, if you did not see him this afternoon, pick up that testimony and watch as he stands, he sits there in front of his own wife, and they plainly are not just somber, they're devastated by the fact that they were misled by a president of the United States of America to do something that compromised their lives. That's the impact of this in the individual way on families in America. That's the impact upon hundreds of people indicted, charged, many of them sentenced already, many of them still under investigation, under prosecution. That is the impact of what he did, what this former president did to Americans, and, as I've said before, his impact upon our psyche generally, further perpetuating this notion that there was, in fact, a steal. We see that to this day in the state of Wisconsin. The news that we just heard about continuing candidates advocating for election reform when, in fact, there is nothing about the past, nothing about the present that suggests that we have got an elective process, we've got a polling process where massive fraud happens on a regular basis. 60 or more judges found exactly that sort of thing, the same kinds of things that happened out there across the country, findings by judges basically rejecting the notion that the big lie is real, rejecting the very thing that Donald Trump was in fact advocating for and continues to advocate for to this very day. And so as we begin to move to the end of our time together, I wanted to focus on a couple things. One of them, again, Liz Cheney, always bringing to a conclusion here with a little nugget of something that's very, very interesting, plainly discussing what's going to happen next. We had heard initially that the committee was going to have a prime time presentation this coming Thursday. They have decided not to do that, so you can watch something else on Thursday evening. But at some point down the road, there will be an eighth hearing and maybe more hearings, and again, anticipating a report from this committee at some point in the late summer, early fall. But at the end of today's hearing, Liz Cheney, as she always does, gives us a little bit of a nugget of something to think about. We recall from the Cassidy Hutchinson testimony of last week that she described the context that she had from people, presumably on behalf of the president, saying, you know what, we anticipate you're doing the right thing. We know that people will be listening to you. And she regarded that appropriately as intimidation, witness tampering. In a broader sense, that's obstruction of justice. Today, Liz Cheney, the vice chair of this committee, returned to that in the very last minutes of the committee hearing. Something you need to watch for at the very, very end. Not a lot of exposition here, but Liz Cheney once again saying, you know what, we've got other evidence of witness tampering with respect to witnesses coming before this very committee. And it's nice to talk about witness tampering and say, well, gosh, you know, you're threatening them, you're doing those kinds of things, and that's horrific. There's a larger understanding of that. That is a crime. That is a crime. You can't do that. And just like you need to show up for a testimonial appearance when you're subpoenaed to do so, likewise, you cannot intimidate witnesses. You can't suggest to them that bad things will happen or that people are watching you. And we are tantalized by the fact that Liz Cheney said at the end of the hearing today that there is more evidence that the committee has that witnesses who are appearing before this very committee are being tampered with, and that the very process of justice, which is the exposition of the truth before this committee, presumably also being pursued by the Department of Justice, that all those kinds of things might be affected by those people out there who don't want the truth to come forward, who are doing this witness tampering, who are engaging in obstruction of justice. That is a violation of the law. It is a violation of Section 7217 of Title 26 of the United States Code. I know, Evan, you know that well. It prohibits...
Yes.
You had that at your fingertips, right?
Yeah.
Prohibits anybody from the executive branch or anyone in a position of responsibility from influencing or in any way affecting the testimony they may give. Obstruction of justice, those kinds of things cannot be had under a federal criminal code. We'll talk about more about that. And a final story that brings us out of the Devil's Advocates radio show this afternoon. Come back after the break. We're talking more about the J6 committee and related events in the United States of America.
Stop this thing.
Kicking ass and taking names since the Wisconsin uprising. The Devil's Advocates.
This is the Devil's Advocates radio show. Good afternoon. Glad to have you with us in our final moments this afternoon. Before we begin to head out and perhaps take at least one more caller in our final moments or so, wanted to highlight another story, not directly related to January 6th, but certainly affiliated with and associated with the kind of conduct that Liz Cheney was chatting about at the end of the presentation today, that is witness tampering or getting after people because you don't like what they're doing. This story came out last week from the New York Times, other places. We all remember Jim Comey, who is the former FBI director, used to be a U.S. attorney, used to be the Deputy Attorney General of the United States of America, and his deputy...
Respected.
He used to be quite respected, absolutely, right? Also notorious, if you will, for a very significant press conference that he had in which he presumably exonerated Hillary Clinton in the midst of the 2016 election from any criminal violations, but opened up all kinds of doors and did something that I think a lot of us to this day regard as highly inappropriate for an FBI official to do. This particular story devolves not from that, but from the fact that obviously Jim Comey ran afoul of Donald Trump as well. Jim Comey fired very notoriously by Donald Trump, as he said to Lester Holt for that rusher thing. And Jim Comey was replaced then by Andrew McCabe at the FBI, who then turns around and reestablishes, reinstates, if you will, the very investigation that Donald Trump hoped to stop. That is the investigation into whether or not there was a Russian involvement in the 2016 election. Ultimately gives rise to the so-called Mueller report and the findings of their report. But long before that, Donald Trump fires Jim Comey. Andrew McCabe is also fired on the eve of when he could have had his tenure basically in stone and got some long-term benefits as a retiree. That ultimately is restored to him. But a lot of misbehavior directed toward Jim Comey, toward John McCabe. And this is a story that comes out very recently. It turns out that these two are also the subject of what's called a National Research Program tax review. It is a very, very invasive tax analysis that can, in fact, lawfully be pursued and is pursued by the U.S. Department of the Treasury, by the Internal Revenue Service. Significantly, the odds of being selected for this kind of very invasive audit in any given year are really minuscule, about a one out of out of nearly about 153 million individual returns, for example, the IRS finds about 5,000, or that's about one out of every 30,000 or so of these. So the chances of your being investigated, being audited under this very invasive process are very, very limited. And turns out that both Jim Comey and Andrew McCabe were, within a couple of years of each other, the subjects of these audits in 2017, 2019. And of course, again, it raises an awful lot of concerns about whether or not they were targeted internal to the Internal Revenue Service. And again, an awful lot of laws out there that prohibit exactly that kind of thing. We don't know. We don't know exactly what happened. But as an awful lot of people, both in government, outside of government, scratching their heads and saying, gosh, is the connection between Jim Comey and Andrew McCabe, the fact that they ran afoul of Donald Trump, the fact that they are subsequently pursued by the Internal Revenue Service, for what it's worth, turns out that Jim Comey overpaid his taxes by about $350. Andrew McCabe, both he and his wife, have to make a few additional payments, which they do. And as a result of that, an awful lot of people out there wondering if, in fact, there is a connection, a use of the IRS by the former president and his administration to get after, could only be regarded as his political enemies. Again, shades of Richard Nixon we talked about in the first hour. And as a matter of fact, there's so much concern about this that indeed the present IRS commissioner appointed by the former president, Donald Trump, has asked that the inspector general of the Internal Revenue Service come in and take a look at this, figure out whether or not there was somewhere in the bowels, in the structure of the Internal Revenue Service, someone who made the decision to go after these two people, high-profile people. Could have happened. Statistically, probably very unlikely, but could have happened. And the inspector general is right now, has opened an investigation, again, with the encouragement, with the support of Charles Rettig, again, the commissioner of the IRS, to find out what's happened. And again, we don't know what the result of that is. It is statistically possible that they were randomly selected. On the other hand, highly unlikely. And we hope that the Internal Revenue Service, not used by the former administration, not used by the IRS generally to go after the president's political enemies. But I raise that again just because of this continuing specter out there of going after people who have things to say, things to do as they operate in government, as they perform their legitimate purposes, including testimony in trials, in administrative proceedings, and in proceedings before houses of Congress, including the House of Representatives, the United States Senate. We know the president had a long, long history of sending out tweets, sending out information, sending out comments about witnesses, both dangling the possibility of pardons, that is the carrot, and also threatening them, implicitly and explicitly, if they do not, in fact, testify in a way, behave in a way that he himself would endorse. And so we'll see what happens with the Comey-McCabe investigation, but underway now to determine whether or not anything untoward happened there inside the Internal Revenue Service. And as we go into our last few moments, we do have another caller from Beaver Dam. Andy, calling in. Glad to have you call, Andy. Your comment or your question.
Well, yeah, Jim, I think with anything, you have to put everything in historical context. And somebody today during the hearing made a comment about it, the Watergate being a Cub Scout deal compared to what this is. And I think anybody that would read about Trump and know the way he operated prior to seeking public office was a guy that you could not, you know, would do anything to get what he wanted, and as a result, he probably, or for sure, would have been a bad choice as a nominee for president. And it's proven that way. I hate to say that he's part of my generation, but, you know, I mean, all the people out there that are still drinking the Kool-Aid, so to speak, right, about the election, it's all fallacy, you know.
It is fallacy, right, Andy? And we won't ascribe any personal responsibility to you, whether or not the former president is a part of your generation or not. We won't tag you with that responsibility. Lots of people have done wonderful things in your generation as well. Andy, your point about history is an important one, right? We need to be thoughtful about what our history has been. We also need to be thoughtful about the future. Plainly, we think about today in the context of Watergate. I just made a reference to Richard Nixon, and I think it was Jamie Raskin who made that connection as well that you've highlighted today. Appreciate very much your comment, your thought, Andy. Call in again, as should other callers down the road. This has been Jim Santel, standing in today for Mike and for others here, joined by Evan, who's been my producer today. Thank you so much, Evan, for being with us. Thank you, all your listeners, all those who called in. This has been the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Join us again. Be safe, be well, and come back again every afternoon, 4 to 6, for the Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Turn down to politics. Politics will turn on you.
There's a good chance I may have committed some light.